You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll look at the rise and fall of online humor and satire sites and find out why social media has been a double-edged sword for internet comedy. First, if you're a Facebook user, you might be getting a message from the company. You'll find out if your personal information may have been improperly shared with Cambridge Analytica. That's the British political consulting firm tied to the Trump 2016 presidential campaign. According to initial estimates, 50 million Facebook users may have been affected, but last week the social media company said more like 87 million, maybe. In response to the controversy, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said the company would soon give users more say over how companies use their digital data, much like European privacy rules that are set to kick in next month. The Federal Trade Commission is looking into whether Facebook broke a 2011 agreement designed to protect users' privacy. Zuckerberg himself is scheduled to testify before two Senate committees tomorrow and a House committee on Wednesday. He talked privately with members of Congress today. Meanwhile, Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg went on a media blitz last week, apologizing for the data harvest. On Fox News, she tried to assure people that Facebook is serious about keeping user information safe.
This is a long process. We are going through and systematically looking. We expect to find more, just like we did this week, and then we're going to proactively come out. We're going to fix the problems, tell people about them. We know that we need to make a different level of investment here, and one we should have done sooner, but we're doing in a very big way now.
So now what? Young Mi Kim is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. She's also a faculty affiliate in the Department of Political Science and the Center for Science and Technology Studies. Young Mi, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What are your thoughts on how Facebook has been responding to this particular controversy?
I believe Facebook making a significant step in the right direction, given that there is no clear data protection or transparency measures right now.
Is this something that Facebook, you think, should have been dealing with in advance instead of kind of playing catch up now?
Of course, they should have done this like before the election and then before they launched the Facebook, the company.
And can you talk about what kind of data, affecting 87 million people here, what kind of data this consulting company ended up with?
So Cambridge Analytica got the personal information of 50 million users, or up to like 87 million users in their friends' networks. So personal information include like a profile information that anything you put users put on the Facebook, and then their friends' information. So that's a significant personal information that the users are not aware that third-party companies like Cambridge Analytica scraped all this like information. So that is a significant problem.
Isn't this a part of how Facebook makes money in the first place? Third-party companies come along, they put apps and things like that on Facebook in order to get access to that kind of data?
Yes, that's correct. Like, that's how the digital media platform works these days. At the digital big data age, like data is money. And then all the information has very useful pieces of information that could be merged with the other data sets, commercial marketing data or voter registration data or public records. Everything is going to be useful for algorithm, like a digital platform services provide and then use for better advertising. But the real problem here, I believe, is that the Cambridge Analytica was hired by dozens of political campaigns, including the Trump campaign. So we gave in our data without consent for a particular political campaigns leaning toward the political disposition. So that is a problem. That's why, in addition to like a general data protection and security measures, Facebook recently announced transparency and accountability for electoral systems, particularly political ads, including both electoral ads and then issue ads.
We're talking to Young Mi Kim from the UW-Madison Department of Journalism and Mass Communication, looking at Facebook in the news this week. Mark Zuckerberg going before Congress to talk about how user data is used and possibly misused. And Young Mi, following up on what you just said, you've been part of research looking at the 2016 election campaign and who was promoting stuff on Facebook and what they were doing. Can you talk about some of your findings?
Sure. The research is to be published in an academic journal. This is like a first, to our best knowledge, that the first largest scale like a scientific research about who are running political ads and who are targeted on the Facebook. So this research looked at the groups and sponsors, like the sources behind divisive issue campaigns, like abortion, LGBT, gun, racial issues, and nationalism and the like, and who are targeted with these messages. What we found is that there are a lot of suspicious groups or unidentifiable unknown actors on digital Facebook, in this case Facebook, and then they ran a large volume of campaigns, but those campaigns are run by like a large number of like small niche groups or sham groups that people never heard of before.
Right. There are some groups that are registered with the Federal Elections Commission. They run TV ads, and they, you found, were responsible for some of the content that was appearing on Facebook during the elections, but not most of it. Is that right?
That's correct. That is like one of the shocking results. We found that only 7 out of 228 groups we identified are FEC groups, like FEC, the groups that did file a report about their political activities to Federal Election Commission. Some of the groups do not have a good disclosure and disclaimer requirements. That's the limitation of the current election law. But some of them, like a half of the groups we found, are suspicious groups that we are not easily identifiable. So like, we matched like a group's names. We searched the groups like through like various databases, like IRS-based data, FEC data, and other like research databases. But we still were not able to find those groups. Some of those groups turned out to be linked to like a Russian Kremlin linked to groups, like a House Intelligence Committee released the public data in part, like back in November 2017. One out of 6 our suspicious groups turned out to be those Russian groups.
And the rest of the suspicious groups, we don't necessarily know who funded them or anything?
No, nothing.
So what do you expect to see change now between Facebook policy, between possible government intervention here? Do you think things will change significantly by this year's elections?
So Facebook announced that they will roll out like new transparency measures in later this spring so that they are better prepared before the midterm election this year. So key things, as I mentioned briefly, is that like they will require some verification processes. All political advertisers have to be verified before posting ads. And then Facebook will require anyone buying issue ads to undergo the same processes. However, what I feel like is that what constitutes political ads or what constitutes like an issue ads? The definition itself is very it's not easy. Like, a lot of like, academic researchers spend like an entire career to research what is political and what is not political, and the legal terms for issue ads, we don't have like a terms like that. Like, we just call like the campaigns that containing it some issues. We call them like issue ads. But what are issue ads? Like, there are still controversies. So I'm not 100% certain that Facebook will be able to clearly identify a political ad and an issue ad. For example, some of the Russian ads we found is just black business, black girls promoting a black business. Is that issue ad? We don't know. So it is. I think at the Facebook level, like a technological digital platform levels, like a self-regulation, have to some limitations.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Youngmi Kim, professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Talked with her about the latest developments in the controversy surrounding Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. First, online comedy and satire sites like The Onion, College Humor, and Funny or Die were booming not too long ago, and it looked like they were ushering in a golden age of online humor. Fast forward a few years, and the same sites have been cutting staff and struggling to keep up their numbers of readers, viewers, and revenue. And social media played a big role in the rise and fall of online comedy. Here's a listen to The Onion, a TED Talk parody on social media.
Social media is the driving force behind the new economy. What does that mean? Nobody knows. I'm a successful social media consultant, even though I've never had a thought or original idea in my life. But because my firm charges lots of money, we've put social media on the tongues of some of the biggest companies in the world without providing an actual service. To survive in the new internet economy, you need to come up with a new service or product that people will want. Not likely, right? But social media eliminates the need to provide value to anyone.
Allison Herman is a staff writer at The Ringer, a website covering sports, media, and pop culture. Her recent piece about the challenges facing online comedy sites is titled Dying Laughing. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, not that long ago, Allison, it looked like a golden age for online comedy. Can you talk about the rise before we get into the fall?
Sure. I should first mention that I actually co-reported this feature with my colleague, Victor Lukerson, who mostly covers the technology side of things at our site. I normally cover comedy and television and more pop culture, so this was kind of a neat fusion of our interests. But we started looking into, you know, the sort of mid-aughts rise of sites like College Humor was a big one, founded by Ricky Van Veen, who was an actual college student at the time, although now, ironically, he actually just started at Facebook. And Funny or Die had major celebrity backing from Will Ferrell and Adam McKay, who wasn't, you know, Oscar nominated them, but was still a really big force in the comedy world. And basically, you know, the aughts weren't quite the wild, wild west, but they were the beginning of the institutionalization of the web. So it was still a relatively even playing field for hubs, like, you know, whether they were web native things like College Humor, Funny or Die, or something like The Onion could start to adapt. And it was before the rise or the true centralization of the internet around these behemoths like Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, which is, you know, once you see that start to shift in the 20-teens, that's when you start to see trouble for all media outlets, not just comedy, but comedy we thought was a particularly acute and interesting example of that phenomenon.
Yeah, what starts to happen as especially Facebook and maybe Twitter as a second choice starts to more and more be the source that points people toward a particular article?
Sure. I thought one of the most interesting quotes that we got for the story, which was from a former staff writer from Funny or Die, which is that no one actually types in www.funnyordie.com into their web browser anymore, or really for any website. We're so much more used to either following the publication on social media or following people we like or trust on social media that then refer us to these sites. But, you know, social media sites have become this like organizing principle where it's like, oh, instead of dealing with the chaos of all these different destinations that I have to keep in my head and remember, I can just go to this one site that takes me to every other site, which initially is incredibly useful for web users. You know, that's why it's so successful. And it's almost helpful for publishers like The Onion because it gives you this free distribution system that instantly connects you to your millions of followers if you're really successful on it. But it also means that you're really dependent on these sites to distribute you. And, you know, as Facebook started to move away from a chronological news feed and towards an algorithmic one, and they're not super transparent about what the algorithm does and how it decides, you know, which pieces of content individual people see, then you start to see them, you know, messing around with the seemingly very direct link between publisher and audience. And once Facebook starts to futz around with that, they also start experimenting with the idea of, you know, publishers paying them to promote and distribute stuff. And they've never been super explicit about this, but a lot of publishers that we talk to seem to suspect that you now basically have to pay Facebook to get a meaningful reach when you're distributing stuff, which almost seems backwards because, you know, you're the ones who are producing the content and Facebook is just ferrying it. But that starts to be a real problem for publishers, and particularly comedy ones.
So these comedy websites, like most websites, make money if they make money by getting people to go there and view it or click or whatever. What do we know about the numbers of people actually doing that at these comedy websites?
I mean, for all websites, it's pretty low for click-through. But I think there were what attracted us specifically to comedy was that there are comedy-specific problems. So, for example, if you're The Onion or Reductress and a lot of your joke is contained in the headline, there's not a lot of incentive to click through. I mean, a lot of Onion pieces now are literally just a photo and a headline, which actually makes it really great as a joke. Like, being compact is a sign of good comedy, but it also means, as far as, you know, the economics of web publishing, people are less likely to click through and see the ads, and then advertisers are less likely to buy the ads. Then you also have the problem of, you know, we didn't get to this before, but the fake news push, the anti-fake news push that Facebook has started implementing. You know, The Onion is quite literally fake news. And so it's not clear whether the algorithm shifts more recently that Mark Zuckerberg has said are intended to prioritize friends and family, which obviously doesn't include publishers or third-party brands. It's not clear whether those are specifically targeting satirical websites, but a few of our sources seem to think that that might have been behind recent traffic depressions.
Talking to Allison Herman with The Ringer, talking about the rise and fall of online comedy websites. Allison, another comedy-specific thing you point out in your piece is that on someplace like Twitter in particular, there's a lot of competition, a lot of funny people who can get there with their funny punchline hot take on current events, maybe even faster than, say, The Onion can.
Yes. And, you know, that's particularly true of topical stories, where if a story breaks, people immediately start riffing. And, you know, the democratization of online comedy is obviously not entirely a bad thing. You know, people have made their name on platforms like YouTube and Vine. And we even talked to people who had broken into mainstream, you know, TV writing jobs just because they managed to break through on something like Twitter. But it also means that if, you know, The Onion, instead of being the one reliable source for satire, all of a sudden it's just one Twitter account among millions. And, you know, I happen to think The Onion is still great and definitely is still cut above the competition. But it also means if you're just an average disengaged Twitter user, you might not, you know, immediately look to The Onion, or to you, The Onion just seems like one voice among many.
You also looked at some maybe lesser, or not as widely known comedy websites that are doing pretty well by their standards, but maybe by looking for a smaller slice of the audience. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So we talked to a couple sites that are more specific in the audience that they target. Reductress is obviously specifically spoofing women's media as opposed to The Onion, which is spoofing, you know, newspapers in general. And they only started in, I believe it was 2013. So they're just 5 years old and they're very small. They currently only have two full-time employees who are their co-founders. But, you know, they have a specificity to their voice that really lets an audience know who they are and appeals to a specific audience. I certainly feel very catered to by Reductress. And then there's another website called Very Smart Brothers that's also, you know, less than a decade old, has two co-founders, is very specific. Their take on culture is much more, you know, filtered through an African-American lens, but it has a similar business model of maybe their ceiling is a little lower, but they have a specific way to get to it. And we also talked to a site with a completely different business model, which is McSweeney's Internet Tendency, the online satire arm of the nonprofit publishing house. And they only have one full-time employee who's the managing editor, and they don't pay their writers, although they're trying to change that soon. But they actually have done extremely well based on topical content in the wake of the election, and they've had a lot of Trump and Trump-adjacent stories that have really broken through, which is interesting because if you're familiar with the history of McSweeney's, they tend to have a very, very narrow, very urbane, very literary sensibility that doesn't necessarily translate into a mass audience.
Allison, the Onion started here in Wisconsin. I'm standing about five blocks from where their offices were for years and years. What do we lose if we start to lose these longer term, by internet standards, longer term comedy institutions like the Onion and Funny or Die and others?
I mean, not to be purely utilitarian about it, but they are these kind of talent farms and stepping stones, and they cultivate people. And, you know, The Onion in particular is a really rigorous editorial process, and it's given us a lot of people who currently work in TV and humor and comedy in general. So I think that's really useful. But also, you know, to get a little more philosophical about it, I think satire is really important, and it's a way, you know, certainly right now things are very chaotic and confusing, and it definitely helps me to know that, you know, Reductress will do something like they dedicated an entire day to sexual assault in the wake of a certain scandal. But it felt really good to know, like, not only that someone understood, but that they were capable of, you know, taking down the something that seems so dark and helping you to address it in a way that takes the piss out of it a little bit. And The Onion, I think, does something similar for just news in general. And, you know, everyone likes to laugh. It's definitely good to have that outlet of entertainment available. So I think there are a lot of different functions that comedy and specifically online comedy serves that are valuable to preserve.
Briefly, Allison, you mentioned that virtually no one goes directly to websites anymore. I still do for some comedy websites. Do you or are you now having written this?
Well, yes. I mean, now that I've been reminded several times by several sources of the importance, I definitely, you know, when I scroll past a funny headline, I like to click through. I also think, you know, The Onion, because it's modeled after a newspaper, this has changed somewhat because they're under new ownership. And as such, they adopted a new publishing system that makes it look a little less like a newspaper website. But you still kind of want to get that front page effect of seeing a bunch of different dissimilar stories positioned against each other. But yeah, I'll admit, you know, I'm in my 20s. I'm a millennial. I definitely have the millennial habit of I have my Twitter feed and I click through to stuff from there. And the reason why that's taken hold is it's genuinely a really convenient and useful way to navigate the web. So
we'll leave it there. Thanks to Allison Herman with The Ringer. She talked to us about a piece she co-wrote titled Dying Laughing on Internet Comedy. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. Now the number of Americans with health insurance is at an all-time high. The Affordable Care Act was signed into law just over 8 years ago. Since then, coverage has been extended to nearly 20 million more people. But despite those gains, thousands of Americans are still deciding to go without health insurance, often because of high costs. A new project from Bloomberg Health News explores why families are making that decision and the trade-offs that come along with it. Drew Armstrong leads the U.S. Health News team for Bloomberg News. He's part of a year-long project that follows 12 families who've decided not to pay for health insurance. Drew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you guys for having me on.
How did this project come together, Drew?
You know, we had been, like a lot of people, spending a huge amount of time writing and thinking about the Affordable Care Act, you know, looking for where it had successfully lowered the rate of uninsured and, you know, and how it had helped people, and also trying to find out where it had failed. And I think, you know, a lot of folks had spent time digging into that, and it, us included. But we also wanted to take a look, you know, now that we're in, I believe, the fourth year of coverage of the law, and think about, you know, there's still these people out there who don't have coverage. You know, not all of them are really poor and don't qualify for Medicaid. Not all of them are 26-year-olds who just, you know, the so-and-so, quote-unquote, young invincibles. But there were these people who we knew thought, you know, that it just wasn't a bargain for them when they stacked it up against other things like having to pay their mortgage or making a car payment or, you know, trying to do something decent for their kids. And they were making this decision to go without. And so we started this project that we called Risking It, where we wanted to look at people who were making really tough kitchen table decisions and, you know, in the squeeze of month-to-month bill paying, health insurance was the thing for them that got squeezed out, and look at what are the consequences of that. You know, why do they make those decisions? And what is it like to try and make ends meet in a health insurance market that can be really tough? And how do people look for workarounds for that?
And before we get into individual stories, let's talk about who is in this situation. It seems like it's people who make too much money to be able to get subsidies for care on the market in many cases, but not enough to be able to afford the premiums that they then end up paying, right?
You know, that is part of it, but we also see people kind of a little bit further down the spectrum as well. Remember that the premiums are based on a sliding scale. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, after about 400% of poverty, you get no help. But the help kind of decreases as you go lower down the increases as you go lower down the income scale. So there are still some people who get help, but it may still not be, they may make the decision that for them and their personal finances, that's enough. There's other people who, maybe they looked for a plan and they didn't find one that fit their doctors, and they said, okay, this would only cost us $300 a month, but for us, that's a lot of money and it doesn't meet our needs, and so we're not going to do it. The thing that I think we learned in doing this is that all of these decisions are very personal for these people, and they were making choices. And I don't think any one of the folks that we talked to made any of these decisions to not be uninsured flippantly. I mean, these were things that they really thought about and tried to see if they could fit in their budget. They thought about it for them. They thought about it for their kids. They thought about it for their personal finances and what impact that would have. And shopping for insurance isn't easy. I think there's probably some people who maybe in a perfect world could have made a better decision, but these are people who have jobs, they're busy, they've got a lot of other worries, and in some cases, maybe they don't make that perfect decision that they could have made if they had a healthcare policy expert sitting beside them, walking them through every last little thing and looking for every last little subsidy.
Talking to Drew Armstrong from Bloomberg News. He's part of a year-long project that follows 12 families who have decided not to pay for health insurance coverage. Drew, let's meet one of the families, the Bobbies. They're a family of four in a suburb of, I think it was Phoenix. Can you share their story?
Correct. Yeah, the Bobbies are a really interesting case study, and we're going to be spending time with them and following them over the course of the year. So the Bobbies, it's the parents, and then they have two kids. They have Joey, who's seven, and is a healthy, great little boy, and Sophia, who is 9 years old. Now, Sophia was born with a number of heart defects and a defect in her abdomen that causes her organs to be in the wrong places. So she spent the first couple weeks of her life in the NICU and had open heart surgery when she was 6 months old. And then she had another abdominal surgery when she was 9 months old. Her medical costs in the first 3 years of her life totaled about $1 million. Now, the Bobbies, Joe Bobby, the father, he runs a Philly steak shop with his brother outside of Phoenix. They make around $55,000 a year right now. And they looked at what health insurance was going to cost for them, which was going to be, several thousand dollars in premiums, and it did not fit in the budget for them. Sophia is the only person in the family who has health insurance. Basically, the family has made the decision that the two parents and Joey, who's seven, are going to go uninsured, and they're going to use the money they pay to pay for her bills and try to make sure that she's covered and gets the care she needs. But the rest of them they fit the bill for our project. They're risking it. They're hoping that nothing happens to them. And if it does, they are in a really difficult situation.
And they and other people you talk to, I mean, that's an anxiety-producing situation, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think but it's an anxiety-producing situation, but it's also, it's also reality for them. They had to make a decision between, do we keep a roof over our heads or do we insure our whole family? And I think if you look at the decision that a lot of people are making, the call is, well, I need a roof tomorrow. I don't know if I'm going to need health insurance in the next month. And when you put it that way, I think those decisions can be a lot easier for people to understand. They know what their needs are right now, and they know that they may have to take a chance on the thing that they're not sure about whether they're going to need.
Drew Armstrong leads the U.S. health news team for Bloomberg News. He's part of a year-long project following 12 American families who have decided not to get health insurance, often because of high costs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you going without? Are you risking it as you see it? If you are uninsured, what led to that decision? What did you compare and contrast? What costs were you looking at? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Drew Armstrong of Bloomberg Health News. He heads up a reporting team that's following 12 families around the country who've decided to go without health insurance, in many cases because of high costs. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How has your health coverage changed over the last 8 years or so? Have recent moves by the Trump administration impacted your plan? Are you going without health insurance? Call and tell us about that. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Drew, I understand you are also looking for people to call in or contact you and share their stories. How can they do that?
Yeah, so one of the things that we included when we ran our first story and introduced a handful of these families, like the Bobbies that we talked about a few minutes ago, who have made the very difficult decision to go without health insurance, is we asked people to fill out a survey on our website on Bloomberg.com and to tell us what they were doing. And we, you know, I'll be honest, when we started this, you know, I kind of thought, well, maybe 10 or 15 people write in. And we got more than 3,000 responses in 3 days from people who wanted to tell us about what they were going through, why they were uninsured or unable to get insurance in 2018. And, you know, because of that, we were able to reach out to a bunch of those folks and have heard from them and, you know, are beginning to tell some additional stories and found some additional people we want to stay in touch with over the year. So it's really been an overwhelming response, the number of people that have responded to this story, and has provided some really great new leads for us to follow up on and help better understand what's going on out there.
I want to bring on a caller now. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hi. I do not qualify. My family doesn't qualify for any subsidies. And the cost of getting insurance, if you can find it, there are very few providers. It cost my family $2,500 per month. And then the insurance company doesn't come out of pocket till I've spent almost $10,000. Then I'm expected to shop for an MRI. It's not like I'm buying tires.
And so, Tim, did you end up making the decision to pay that high cost, or are you going without?
I'll pay the high cost. I'm not going to take the risk of something happening to my family. And I'm fortunate that I can pay it. But if you're in that small minority, it is unbelievable. And you have no choice. There are no choices of doctors, plans. There's nothing. You get what you get.
Tim, thanks a lot for that call. Is that the kind of story you're hearing a lot of, Drew?
Yeah, Tim sounds exactly like the people we're hearing from, to be honest. We have heard over and over from people who see similar deductibles to what he was saying, you know, $5,000, $10,000 for a family. And already with really costly premiums for a family as well. I mean, it's just that he sounds exactly like the type of folks we've been hearing from by the hundreds, where, you know, they look at it, I think, and say, okay, I'm going to pay $2,500 a month. That's going to add up to close to $30,000 in premiums a year. I'm going to have a $10,000 deductible. So by the time I'm even using my insurance benefits, I'm $40,000 out of pocket. And I think, you know, there's people who are lucky enough to be able to pay some of that. And there's other people who say, I'm trying to keep the gas on. And, you know, we talked to someone in West Virginia who in the middle of February had to decide between whether or not, who was uninsured and had to, and went to the hospital because she had pneumonia, which she didn't go to the hospital before because she had, you know, she had a flu and she said, I don't have insurance. I don't want to go see the doctor because I can't pay for it. It got worse. She got pneumonia. They gave her prescriptions at the ER. She had to decide between, do I pay the couple hundred dollars it's going to take for me to fill my prescriptions, or do I keep the gas on and the temperature's going down to 19 most nights? People really have a hard time with this stuff at all different income levels. And what Tim is describing is something we have heard from over and over and over again about people who say, you know, I'm going to have to pay all this money. I'm not even sure when I'm going to, how much it's going to actually be worth. I've got to spend 10 grand more before I'm really getting some benefits here. People are pretty frustrated about this kind of stuff.
Tim, thanks for that call and good luck. We'll go next to Janine on the line in Madison. Janine, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Janine?
Well, right now we're lucky and have insurance. However, we went through a stage a few years back where my husband became unemployed. We couldn't afford COBRA insurance because we were looking at $2,400 a month COBRA without having any income coming in from him. and we consciously made the decision we didn't qualify for Badger Care, and so there's no insurance because we barely had enough money to sustain our household, and we're living off of credit cards until he got rehired somewhere. So insurance was the least of our expenditures. That went to the wayside.
Janine, thanks for the call. So insurance was the least of the problems at that point, Drew.
Yeah, this is another thing we hear. People who go between jobs and they face these things. And, you know, what Janine was describing, it's kind of, you talk to people, they say, listen, I've got student loans to pay. I've got credit cards I got to pay off. I have to make a car payment so I can get to work. I need to pay my mortgage or my rent so I can keep a roof over my family and my family's head. We've heard from a number of people who the reason they aren't insured, is because they have $20,000 to $30,000.
We are losing our connection with you, yes. Drew. We've got you back. I'm going to take a caller now. We'll go to Tracy on the line in Milton. Tracy, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Tracy.
Hello?
Yep, go ahead.
I've never been insured. I have pre-existing condition. I have lupus, and I'm actually I consider myself a very healthy lupus patient. And so when it came down time for the marketplace, when I went there, it was $1,400 a month for me to get insurance with a high deductible. The only insurance that I could afford, which is around $350 a month, was non-healthcare compliant. So I have pay into a group co-op called Christian Healthcare Services, Christian Healthcare Ministries. And although I don't use it, it's $150 a month and it's a cost share, but it's not considered insurance. But it's my stopgap for trying to make something work. In the meantime, I have my job is, farming and horse training. And, so it's very high risk. I'm outside. I do get sick. I happen to have a wonderful doctor that, if I get bronchitis or pneumonia, I call him up on the phone and, he gives me a prescription for a Z-Pak. And I can carry on my merry way, but, I really have no other recourse if I were to have a major accident.
Tracy, thanks a lot for that call, and fingers crossed that we have a better connection. Drew, this is something that a lot of people are doing.
I'm losing some of your audio here.
Okay. These Christian co-ops, some of the people you talked to had that. Can you tell us about that? Nope, I think we've lost Drew. We've been talking to Drew Armstrong. He is part of a year-long reporting project at Bloomberg following 12 American families who have decided to forego health insurance. You can still share your story with them with the link on our website at wpr.org/centraltime. As he mentioned earlier, there was a survey there where you can add your own experience to that story. And you can also share your story with your fellow listeners of Wisconsin Public Radio at at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us your experience paying for insurance or not and the kind of expenses you're facing there. A two-year battle to build a frac sand plant on 16 acres of rare wetlands in Monroe County is coming to a head this spring. A Milwaukee judge will decide if the Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin followed the law when it approved that project last year. As Rich Kramer reports, DNR staff say they were forced by agency leaders to approve that wetland permit despite objections and a lack of information, they say, from the company.
Atlanta-based Meteor Timber's plan to build a sand mine and rail loading facility near the town of Millston in Monroe County includes filling more than 13 acres of rare white pine red maple swamp. The plan would reportedly fill more wetlands than any other frac sand facility in the state. And former DNR wetland ecologist Pat Truckles says these are some of the most exceptional wetlands she's ever seen.
This was a very large fill, a very high-quality wetland. And in the past, that's enough reason to say no and to deny a permit.
Despite reservations among staff, the DNR approved Meteor's permit last May. Spokesman Jim Dick declined to comment, but emails obtained through an open records request show scientists were frustrated by a lack of information from the company and tight internal deadlines. Trunkle says they were expected to approve Meteor's permit no matter what, told what questions they could ask, and given limits for groundwater monitoring wells at the site.
I don't know who made the decision. It was always like somebody from 8th floor is saying, we can only have so many wells.
What is 8th floor?
That's our administration, like Kathy Stepp.
Emails show that Meteor Timber attorney John Bailing communicated with DNR administrators, including former Deputy Secretary Kurt Thiede. Bailing, who is also president of the UW System Board of Regents, has worked with dozens of frac sand operations in western Wisconsin. He says he worked with the DNR at all levels during a permitting process in which he submitted more than 5,000 pages.
It's a comprehensive proposal. Everyone from the DNR has been welcome. And consequently, we talked to all the stakeholders that deal with wetlands in terms of the importance of this project and the benefits it brings to the state.
Meteor Timber says the project will be a net environmental benefit for Wisconsin because the company plans to convert cranberry beds into more than 30 acres of hardwood swamp and preserve 296 acres of wetlands on the property. Meteor has also pledged to preserve 180 acres of wetlands on another parcel nearby. Bailing says the project will create 100 jobs and make annual payments to nearby towns. Even before the DNR approved Meteor's wetland permit, environmental law firms Clean Wisconsin and Midwest Environmental Advocates said they would challenge it on behalf of members of the Ho-Chunk Nation.
And this was one permit that we looked at, and there was just giant red flags associated with it.
That's Clean Wisconsin Program Director Amber Meyer-Smith. She says one red flag was missing information about soil and water movement where Meteor plans to create wetlands. Smith says those things are usually considered before a permit is issued. With Meteor's permit held up in court, a company lobbyist was working the halls of the state capitol. In a pair of late-night maneuvers, a Republican assemblyman from southeastern Wisconsin added amendments to unrelated bills to exempt Meteor Timber from state wetland regulations. Smith says it's an example of the type of corporate citizen Meteor wants to be.
Meteor Timber went to the legislature and asked for special legislation to bypass this entire legal process. And that's really troubling, and that is a part of the process that I think speaks to what has happened with this permit all along.
But Meteor Timber Director of Real Estate Chris Mathis says his company has already gone above and beyond in working with state regulators and local governments. He says the legislature was right to try to get this project moving.
The appeal process can be lengthy and time-consuming. We've been at this for a very long time, and we think that because of the environmental benefits that our project creates, the economic benefits for the local economies, and the local support that we have for our project, that it's worthy of consideration.
The Meteor amendments never made it to a vote in the state Senate. Republican Senator Rob Coles of Green Bay opposed the measures, calling them outrageous. The administrative law judge could rule on Meteor Timber's wetland permit by the end of the month. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For more on this story and other news from around Wisconsin, visit WPR.org/news.